committee to order. Let the record reflect, it is 1:32 p.m. on Friday, March 18th, 2022. Today, we have myself, Co-Chair Merrick, Co-Chair Foster. Online, I don't see any legislators online.
Madam Co-Chair, this is Rep. Rasmussen, I'm online.
Great. Representative Rasmussen is with us. I believe Representative LeBon is with us.
And Representative LeBon is online.
Great. Thank you, Representative. This afternoon, we will hold a second hearing on SB 9, the Title IV rewrite, and House Bill 149, Child Care Provider Collective Bargaining. And if we do have time, we will hear an introduction of House Bill 289, Marijuana Industry Task Force. We've also been joined by Representative Ortiz. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. We've been joined by Representative Josephson. First, we will hear Senate Bill 9, Alcoholic Beverage Control, Alcohol Regulations by Senator Machicki. Welcome back, Senator. We heard this bill on March 10th and ran out of time during the presentation, so we will pick up on slide 27. Senator, welcome back. Mr. Jackson, welcome back as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Peter Machicki, District O, and of course we were presenting with Ms. Brawley, who's our coordinator, and I can move the slides if we're on slide 29, Madam Chair.
I believe 27.
Thank you, and thanks for having us back this afternoon.
Please continue.
Okay, Ms. Brawley.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me, Chairperson?
We can. Thank you very much. If you'd place yourself on the record and continue the presentation.
Yes, thank you. For the record, my name is Anna Brawley. I'm up here in Anchorage, and I'm the Title IV Review Coordinator and work at AgNuVet Consulting.
Great. Thank you. Let the record reflect. We were joined by Representative Thompson at 1:34 p.m.
Okay, thank you. So through the chair to the committee, I'll continue the presentation, and of course, if there are questions from last time, we can entertain those as well. So I'm looking at slide 27. So last week we discussed the new provisions in SB 9 to regulate internet sales. So here I'm gonna contrast that with a system that's already in place. So this slide explains what's there now that's not being proposed to change, and then we'll move on with the policy recommendation. So in Title IV, there is a provision for folks who live in local option areas who are allowed to order or import alcohol. So some communities don't allow any possession or sale of alcohol at all. Others allow importation. So there's a system in place. There's a monthly limit on what you can order. You can see on the left of the slide that's what's in current statute. And the process is that a Alaska customer orders from an in-state package store. They go through the process of confirming they're 21, whether they've met the order limit. And the way that the ABC board tracks that limit is there's a database. It's called the Written Order Database. And it has limited access. It's not intended to be a public database because it does have individual orders, but that's where package stores will check to make sure that a customer can order up to their monthly limit, and then they enter it in the database so that it's an enforcement purpose. And so the only folks who have access to that are the ABC board, package stores who participate in this system, and law enforcement. And so that's the system that we have today. That is separate from what we're proposing for internet sales, which of course is primarily for customers not in local option areas who would be ordering from in-state or out-of-state. But if we move to slide 28, what is proposed to be changed is currently all of the information in this database is private and it's deleted after 1 year. So on an individual level, that's good because it protects privacy. However, at an aggregate level, so taking individual order information out of the equation and just looking in total about how much alcohol is being shipped to each community each year would be valuable for communities and for the public, particularly as Senator Machicki has said multiple times, that we need to we need to get a handle on bootlegging, and communities are certainly interested in that. And so the proposal is to require that the ABC board keep the data for 10 years instead of purging the system every year. They would not release or publish any individual order data, so not the customer's information, not who ordered what, and not which store they ordered from, but really looking at the aggregate and saying, you know, for this region or for this community, here's how many gallons in total were ordered in a year. And then the ABC board would publish an annual report by community or by region. And so the details of that would be worked out in regulation, as would most things in this bill if they changed. But that is the general idea, is to make use of the data we already have, again, protecting privacy, but making sure that that information is available.
Great, thank you. Let the record reflect at 1:36 p.m. We were joined by Representatives Wool and Edgman. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. Through the chair to the committee. So then moving on to slide 29, these are, again, the kind of remaining provisions, policy provisions in the bill that we didn't already cover. So slide 29 really illustrates, you know, the complicated system of penalties. So currently in Title IV, by default, almost all violations of the statute are Class A misdemeanors. So that's everything from things that should be misdemeanors, you know, like serving a minor, to down to, you know, not having the signage put up properly, or things that in other instances would be considered more minor offenses or violations. And so the stakeholder group went through line by line, looked at every single section in Title IV, those that do have penalties, you know, where you could violate that section, and discussed what the appropriate penalty should be, because the issue is if everything is set too high across the board and these penalties are considered too strict for these offenses, then they're not necessarily getting moved forward or they're not being consistently enforced. And that was a huge discussion, not only to ensure that we are addressing, you know, bad operators, but also to make sure that it's fair, and that we correct issues that come up and can separate a one-time mistake from, you know, a habitual offender, essentially. And so the proposal is to clearly define the penalty for each section, as opposed to the system where most are kind of defined across the board. And then this slide really just illustrates the difference between those. And so, again, the goal is not to reduce reduce penalties on serious violations, you know, risk to health and safety, you know, addressing minors, that kind of thing, but to really find a way to make the enforcement easier, more consistent, and, again, to separate those bad operators and deal with that versus, you know, folks who are trying to do the right thing.
Great. Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, to our expert, I guess, Ms. Browley, I think it is. Is the crime of furnishing alcohol to a minor the same? Is that still a C felony under the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the penalty now is actually not a C felony in most cases for serving a minor. And on the next slide, we'll cover a different situation. But for an adult who serves a minor, you know, for example, provides buys a drink at a bar for someone who's underage, that would be still a misdemeanor.
Thank you.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I had the same question, but your last comment gave me pause, because you just said if someone buys a drink for a minor at a bar, it is a misdemeanor, and that's assuming they know they're a minor. I mean, sometimes people get in with fake IDs, and you assume everyone in a bar is 21, as do the bar employees, and that's how bar employees get charged with these violations, is that they don't know. And so if someone, you know, somehow gets in a bar who is underage and they get served, that is a misdemeanor? Is that what I just heard you say?
Senator Michicki?
Thank you. So the proof and the standard that is used in charging someone has not changed. What's changed is how it's classified as either a violation, a misdemeanor, or a felony. So if you were innocent, if you were able to prove your innocence through a fake ID at because of a case in the past that likely wasn't prosecuted because it was too high a crime and Department of Law is backed up and they often didn't go through the effort to prosecute some of these crimes, which is why we dropped some to a violation, that doesn't change. So what made you innocent or guilty before, had you been charged and prosecuted, has not changed. There's simply been an adjustment to the level of some of the offenses.
Follow up.
Thank you. I support the lowering of the intensity of the crime level for the aforementioned violation of serving a minor. I had employees when I had a bar, like a door person, a security guard, checking ID, and for one reason or another, they read the date wrong, or they did the math wrong, or they were confused, or they were overloaded with people trying to get in. They unknowingly let someone in underage, and that person was charged with a misdemeanor and was told if he did it again, it would be a felony. So he quit, which I don't blame him one bit. So if that were to happen under the new Title IV, that same thing, a security guard or a bartender who sees someone in who assumed that the security guard checked their ID, but maybe they didn't do a very good job of it, we're reducing that to a violation across the board, or could it still be a misdemeanor? And I'm waiting for the clear answer.
So it's a different question. I'll give you a clear answer to the current question. Clear answer to the current question we can cover on the next page. And current Title IV, a licensee or employee who knowingly, that word is included in the law, overserves an intoxicated adult who serves alcohol to a minor is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. This would change it to a minor offense. The reason it's going to become a minor offense is none of those were charged or prosecuted and haven't been for a very long time for a number of reasons, one of them being the courts being backed up on much more serious crimes. It will now be a minor offense with a $500 fine. And we actually have a little diagram for that on the next page we get for it to it that I think will explain it. And the goal, of course, to hold people accountable with something that actually works. It's deliverable. You would have the same offense, perhaps, if you were going to challenge it like we talked about earlier. That hasn't changed, but we feel like this violation, minor offense, is going to be a lot more universally applicated and or applied. And you'll see that it also, when the server knowingly serves an intoxicated adult or a minor, that the licensee will also receive a $250 administrative fine from the board. So maybe we should go to the next slide.
Just one moment, please. Let the record reflect at 1:43, we were joined by Representative Johnson. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Maybe I just don't know, but out of curiosity, it seems, isn't there where somebody drinks too much, constantly repeat offender, the courts have a mark on their driver's license? Is that still in effect, or is that what they do? I mean, you know, you're supposed to check the ID, and if it says you got a red line through your put on by the court, you can't serve that person. How does this fit into what we're doing here?
Madam, through the chair, Representative Thompson, it doesn't change that system.
Okay. And what is the fine? Excuse me. Follow up. What's the fine for serving somebody that has that on their license?
I will leave that to Ms. Brawley to answer, but I don't believe it changes anything about that system. This is what we're talking about here is the change from a Class A misdemeanor to a minor offense for over-serving an intoxicated adult or who serves alcohol to a minor.
Ms. Brawley?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Thompson, that's correct. We did look at all of the penalties in the statutes and also consulted with, attorneys, Department of Law, and a host of others, and so did really try to separate what are the serious crimes and what should be considered that from some of these kind of more routine issues, and as Senator Michiki said, the next slide covers the situation of a employee serving somebody inappropriately, but that has nothing to do with the license, the driver's license system.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you. So what is the penalty if you serve somebody that has a restriction on their driver's license? What is the penalty?
Madam Chair?
Senator?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Thompson, Director Klinkhardt is on the line, which would be an excellent resource to answer that question.
Great, thank you. We have Glenn Klinkhardt, Director, Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. Mr. Klinkhardt, welcome to House Finance. Please put yourself on the record.
Thank you very much. I hope you can hear me okay.
Yes, we can. Thank you.
All right, and for the record, this is Glenn Klinkhardt. I am the Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Board. And if I may, through the chair, to Representative Thompson, that's a very good question. And to be honest, I haven't written that ticket in a while. I've been a law enforcement officer for almost 25 years. But I tell you what I will do is I will find out and I will get back to you ASAP.
Thank you very much. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I know part of my experience has been dealing with that situation. And I remember when I had a business that had entertainment that also served alcohol, the law, as I interpreted it, said someone could enter your establishment for the purposes of entertainment, but they couldn't drink. And if they did drink, it was on them. In other words, the penalty was on the person consuming. They were the ones that were supposed to follow the law to not drink. I think some liquor stores will card absolutely everyone that walks in looking for that red stripe, but I believe it, the onus is a responsibility is on the person with the red stripe and not so much the establishment. As I said before, they can enter a place for entertainment. They can't enter a liquor store for entertainment.
Great, thank you. Ms. Brawley, please continue.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I'll continue to the committee. So moving to slide 30, so again, the goal was really to not to reduce penalties arbitrarily, but really to look at what would be the most effective way to enforce these statutes. And again, to separate, threats to life and safety or serious crimes from, like I said, these more routine business compliance issues. And so one that we did focus on in particular is what happens when an employee either serves a minor, so this is on licensed premises, as Representative Wolf said, presumably they've had their ID checked, and so the presumption is that at that time might be that they're there legally. And that's one situation. The other is if somebody is overserved. So if somebody knowingly, and again that word knowingly, overserves an intoxicated adult. And so the proposal is to change that penalty from a Class A misdemeanor to a minor offense or a violation that comes with a $500 ticket, as Senator Michiki said. And then the other piece of it was closing the other loophole that the group discussed, which was if a licensee doesn't know that these things are happening on their premises, they don't have an opportunity necessarily to quickly act and correct that issue. So whether it's a training issue or maybe there's a string of them and it's a problem employee or just some kind of gap that they need to address. And so the goal is to really encourage compliance with the law, especially if they have a training program in place and generally have a good record, wanting to separate, what might be a mistake from a habitual, bad operator or somebody who routinely allows over-service on their premises or is not great about checking IDs and letting minors in. So that really gives the ABC board more tools to separate those out and address those violations. And it allows for the licensee, again, they're not getting a criminal charge, they're not getting a violation, but they are getting an administrative fine, and so they can quickly act and know that it happens. Because, for example, the owner of the license may have a manager who doesn't, disclose that this happened, and so they might not find out about it until a year and a half later when their license is up for renewal. So again, we really talked a lot about closing those loopholes and really helping the ABC board and help AMCO and local law enforcement really hone in on these issues and to be able to correct them.
Thank you. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Overserves an intoxicated adult. I'm assuming, I don't know what the definition of intoxicated. I know if you're driving a motor vehicle, it's 0.08 blood alcohol, but that's not the definition in a alcohol establishment. Do you have a definition in this bill?
Senator?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Wohl, this bill does not change the definition, nor does it deal with the definition. It simply takes something from a misdemeanor to a more effectively managed minor offense.
Thank you. Ms. Brawley.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then we'll move on to the last slide in the presentation, which is 31. This is another, again, targeted change to penalties and to policy to really address, you know, the issue of underage drinking. And so this is actually considered a best practice in the public health world. The cities of Anchorage and Juneau actually already have this in their local code, so this would simply, you know, replicate that system statewide, and that is keg registration. So this is, again, trying to address the issue of, say, an adult goes to a package store, legally purchases, you know, a keg, and everything is legal up to that point, but then they turn around and give it to underage drinkers for a party. And so the enforcement is not so much at the point of sale. It's really the point that adult provided that alcohol to minors. And so the way that this system works is it simply is mostly paperwork, actually. So there's a registration system that would put a tag on the keg, which would include who purchased it, you know, the date, all of those things. And so that way, you know, if the keg then ends up at a party with responsible adults, like you can see on the slide, then there's no enforcement issue. It was used as it was intended. Often kegs are basically rented and returned to package stores, so that it's the contents that are being purchased. And so then if that keg is returned, no issue, the tag is removed, and that transaction is complete. If that keg is confiscated, for example, at a party with underage drinkers, or you know, say it got in the hands of some kids, and then the police were breaking up a party, for example, this would allow for tracing back the purchaser, you know, which again, the purchase itself was legal, but the illegal part was providing it to minors. And so it's a way to hold the purchaser accountable, and also a way to distinguish the liability or the responsibility from the package store, who, you know, who completed a legal sale and had every reason to think that it was legal. And so this system is really in place for that specific situation, and it helps law enforcement address this issue of finding kegs at parties, essentially. And that would result in a ticket, again, not to the store but to the purchaser for their illegal act.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, I'm sure that I'm just not seeing this, but one of the things I'm watchful of is just sort of the criminality element, and I understand that we want something that works, and so I appreciate that, and I appreciate the sponsor finding that solution. But just feathering through Title IV, there's a section I've never heard of. It's aggravated penalties for certain violations involving a person under 21 committed by a sex offender or child kidnapper, and it's 059, but I don't – did that get renumbered or something? Or taken up in a different area? Or perhaps we're not rewriting all of Title IV. Is that the other possibility?
So, Madam Chair, there's a chance that, so I don't remember where that specific piece is located. Mr. or Director Klinkhart might be best for that. Most of the sections will be renumbered. I don't know if it changes that particular numbering.
Mr. Klinkhart?
Yes, for the record, this is Glenn Klinkhart, Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Board. I was actually just looking that one up as well, but I do not believe that it is covered in this rewrite.
Representative Josephson.
So does that mean that it just remains as written?
That would be my understanding through the chair.
Follow-up, then.
Yes, follow-up.
I think an easier question. A constituent, Steve, across the street, during community council, we have those in Anchorage, he expressed concern with keg registration. He said, essentially, he homebrews, and he must have kegs, and he thought that the registration applied to him. It does not apply to him, does it?
Senator.
It's a common question we've gotten. Perhaps it's the same individual that has asked that question of Senator Wilikowski several times. This does not deal with private homebrews. You would have the same rights that you always had.
Great, thank you. Representative Edgman.
Are we just questions at large?
At large.
So going back to slide 30, I just want to follow up on a question that Representative Wool asked, and that's the intoxicated adult and why there wouldn't be thresholds in law. I mean, if a police officer pulls somebody aside on the, you know, in the car, it's 0.08, right? But in the bar, it's the eye tests, I guess.
Senator Machicki?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Edgman, through the chair. I actually didn't say that. What I said is that standard has not changed through this bill, simply the classification of the offense has. So whatever standard they're using today for an overserved adult or overserving an intoxicated adult is the same standard that exists today. We're just simply changing how it's classified as an offense.
Madam
Representative
Chair,
Edgman.
First off, Senator Machicki, I didn't say you said that. And the second thing is, my question is, why isn't it defined? If you got an omnibus bill here in front of us defining everything else, and I think it's a genuine question, and maybe the answer is you can't, you know, if you have somebody who's inebriated in a bar, what do? You give them a drug alcohol, a blood test right there on the spot. I don't know if that's practical or not, but, you know, maybe this just, and I'm looking across the way at a former bar owner, you know, maybe it's just something that's not, again, practical.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to give you my experience. From a position of a former bar owner, people do come in and drink, and you don't monitor how much everyone drinks, and you don't know how much they drank before they came in. I mean, you monitor people's behavior, and if they act inappropriately or overly intoxicated, you stop serving them. But the idea that everyone has to be at 0.08 or less to be legally out in a bar is, for one, it's not realistic, and two, it's the 0.08 is for operating a motor vehicle, and that's why we have that law. You don't want anyone driving above a 0.08, but if they're going to a concert and they have a couple beers or who knows, as long as they're outwardly not acting, you know, staggering, slurring, and I believe that's the definition in statute, outward signs of intoxication, and you know, that's why you take the TAMS class or the TIPS class, so you're familiar with these signs and able to identify them, and that's when you cut people off and stop serving them. And but the idea is, if someone is over the line and you don't want to keep serving them, and that's apparently overserves an intoxicated adult. So I just wanted to make sure that definition of intoxicated adult wasn't getting redefined to a numerical blood alcohol, because, you know, I think the last thing that people who own these kind of places want is law enforcement going through giving breathalyzers to everyone in the room, because on any given hour and any given night, someone might be over 0.08, which I don't think the idea is to make that illegal, but you don't want them getting in their car at that level, and you want them getting a ride home or taking a taxi or something like that.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
So a DUI is a different standard, clearly, right? And there's also a different standard for operating a commercial vehicle. But the one that you're asking about, Representative Edgman, is a drunken person, which is defined in 04-21-080-B9, and that is a drunken person. So that's how it's referred in the that is not legal to serve a drunken person. That means a person whose physical or mental conduct is substantially impaired as a result of the introduction of an alcoholic beverage into the person's body, and who exhibits those plain and easily observed or discovered outward manifestations of behavior commonly known to be produced by the overconsumption of alcoholic beverages.
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, and that might be as precise as we can get it. I mean, because you can't, again, administer a breathalyzer to, you're in a crowded bar and you've got 200 people or whatever, and you've got 10 of people of this nature, but it was just an observation of mine, and, you know, I also, you know, been in a bar where somebody is not an alcohol, but they demonstrate a pretty impaired state of mind as well. And so, you know, I thought that was a reasonable question.
Thank you. I see nothing further. Ms. Bradley?
Yes, thank you, to the chair. So that is our last slide. So slide 32 is just contact information. So that concludes the presentation.
Great, thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And maybe I missed it by showing up a little bit late today, but we're talking about changes in this bill from existing law. And I guess I was looking for the increased hours of tasting rooms, the change in the population cap, and the live music. And is that in this presentation that we have in front of us?
Ms. Brawley, I'm sorry, that's the chair's job.
Ms. Brawley, did you hear Representative Wool's question?
Yes, thank you to the chair, Representative Wool. So I don't believe that we outlined the specifics of that in the presentation, but I'm just flipping back. Yeah, I think we did not write it out, but slide 10 is where it covers that that situation. But the changes that are proposed for the tasting rooms, if I remember correctly, is that it would extend the hours to 10 p.m., but that there would also be a quote-unquote hard close, meaning that people have to be off premises at 10 p.m., not just that serving stops the way that it is today. I understand serving stops at 8 p.m. and then folks can linger. And then there is also a provision allowing for limited live entertainment, mostly through a new permit system, and there's a limit on the number of permits per license per year for that live entertainment.
Representative Wall.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I mean, it's a noted omission that it isn't in your presentation, and I know this was an amendment in Senate Finance a couple of years ago, so, and I know this bill changes every year or two with additions and subtractions, so, but to me, this is, as a former BDL owner, beverage dispensary license, this was a hot issue for years now, and I know some kind of deal was struck with the brewers, and I guess they're going to testify today, and Char. So it says limited sales volume on page 10, limited hours, limited sales volume. But no real detail was given on that. And those of us who have been around and heard this bill a few times may remember the limited hours and limited sales volume. Population cap was another consideration. And I think, was there a page on that too, Ms. Brawley?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Wool. I don't recall if that was specifically called out. And I know that there's a lot of details in the bill, and so over the years we've also narrowed down the number of slides, frankly, just to be respectful of the committee's time.
Thank you. Would it be possible to provide those answers in writing to us?
Yes, Madam Chair, we can do that.
Great. Thank you. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Yeah. And again, I've been here. This is my eighth year in the legislature, and I think we've seen Title IV in every legislature, not, I don't know about every year of every legislature, but the last four legislatures. And it does change for various details. So I think it's important to put some of the changes in. The population cap, I think as it stands currently in current law, is one license per 3,000 people, whether it's a BDL or a tasting room license, and that a REPL, restaurant eating place license, is one per 1,500. And I believe that's been in law for a long time. So to go from one per 3,000 to one per 12,000 is a significant change, and I think that's worthy of not only putting in your slideshow, but of discussion, which I'm sure it will happen.
Thank you. Representative Thompson. Senator? Did you have a comment?
I do. It's a 125-page bill. The original presentation, I think, was 72 slides. Every committee has requested that we cut it down. I can speak in detail about what was changed. We do essentially every time the bill comes up, and I'd be happy to cover it in detail if you'd like. Is now a good time to do that, or would you like to do it at another period of time, Madam Chair?
Why don't we go ahead and finish this up, and we can have our invited testifiers, and then if there's still questions.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm going back to slide 12. It references endorsements. You've got bowling alley endorsement, all kinds of different endorsements. I was curious, because I know this has been a question and an item in the past, is how about a golf course? Are they a special endorsement needed to have a serving on a golf course?
So thank you, through the chair, Representative Thompson. The golf course is actually a license and not an endorsement. An endorsement is kind of an add-on for another license type so that you can design your business for exactly what you're doing. When there's a specific license, you'll find a golf course license on page 21, section 0409300, and that is a specific biennial fee for a golf course license itself. So it's not an endorsement, it's an individual license type.
Representative Thompson.
So if a golf course had a restaurant and a bar inside the building, and at the same time, beside the bar is where they rent the clubs and you pay for the going out on the course, how does that fit with being able to serve them something away from the building itself? They're out on the golf course. Is that I'm a little confused there.
So you're talking about a couple different things. If you wanted to have like this amazing restaurant, full service bar, golf course thing, that's not really the same thing as a golf course license. A golf course license allows you to serve on the course, and is specifically designed for what you're talking about, where you could go out, someone with a drink cart, and serve. Yes.
Follow up then, a little confusion there to me. I'm maybe not getting it completely. How does that work then if you have a restaurant, bar, et cetera? Can they go out then and serve on the golf course? That's the questions that I've heard.
Representative Thompson, through the chair, if that's
okay.
Senator?
So you would, if you had if you were a BDL holder, you could serve a full bar across the whole course. So the golf course license is different, which only allows service of beer and wine on the course.
So BDL, they can serve the whole course.
Yes, because of a change in this bill, it allows them. But that is a full BDL and not a golf course license.
Correct. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for the bill sponsor, I'm just curious how the one license per 12,000 person population cap for breweries, distilleries, and wineries compares to other state population caps, or do you have a little insight on licensing for these types of businesses in other states?
Senator.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. We, Lee Ellis from the Brewers Guild is one of our invited testifiers today, and I think he would be a really great resource for that. He's provided me with a lot of data, but I think he's the right person to deliver it in comparison to other states, which I think we all know we're all over the place, but he would be able to give a better rendition of that data, I believe.
Thank you. Mr. Ellis? Are you available? If so, please put yourself on the record and help Representative LeBon with his question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Lee Ellis, President of the Brewers Guild of Alaska, and I'm going to ask if the representative could repeat the question. Unfortunately, my audio is a little broken, and it's been a little difficult to follow along.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the question was comparative with other states. We're looking at one per 12,000 person population cap for breweries, distilleries, and wineries. I'm just wondering, are we typical? Are we going to be above the norm or below the
the average among other states, or do you have a little insight into how Alaska would compare?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, through the chair, thank you for your question, Representative LeBlanc. That is an excellent question. The Brewers Guild spent a lot of time looking at those numbers and trying to really understand what that meant. And I was actually, to compare, Alaska has a very low number of brew pubs. So when you look at national averages, you're actually looking at brew pubs and what we consider in Alaska to be tasting room models. An important thing to know is the tasting room model only exists in about four states in the U.S. Most other states allow for full retail licenses for breweries. But the total number of breweries that would be allowed under SB9 with just tasting room would actually hit a population number, you know, because different communities will be allowed one, but they'd only have 2,000. The actual density of total breweries that would be allowed would hit somewhere around 1,000 to 7,000 in actual total population of over 21-year-olds. If that were to occur, if we were to fill out all of those retail licenses for tasting rooms only, Alaska would have the densest brewing community in the world. So the Switzerland has the most breweries per capita, and they exist at about a 1,000 to 9,000. And again, that includes brew pubs and small breweries like tasting room. Seattle, Washington has 1 to 9,500, which is a very dense place. So it would definitely allow for Alaska to have more breweries than any other place on Earth.
Representative LeBon.
Yes, as a follow-up to that answer then, for Alaska, and the person count is not adults, it's just total population. So how many communities in Alaska then are already limited out at the 1 per 12,000 person population for breweries, distilleries, and wineries?
So at the 1 per 12,000 for the retail license, there would be a number of communities that would be capped out. Some of those communities are capped out currently, and they would remain capped out. Communities that would now become capped out would include Sitka, and Juneau, as far as we can tell, and I believe Wasilla, but other than that, the communities will still have available opportunities for retail tasting room.
Thank you. This is Representative Merrick. How many are already tapped out at this point?
Through the chair, the current amount of tapped out, I believe, includes Homer, Haynes, Ketchikan's kind of a questionable one because there's kind of an interesting brewing operation going on there. And then Palmer, and I'm trying to think, there was one other one. That's as far as I know for right now. Oh, Skagway. Sorry, Skagway is also included on that as well.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative LeBon.
And that'll do it for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you. I couldn't hear everything that Mr. Ellis said. But if you take the total population of Alaska and divide by 12,000, you come up with one number. But as we know, we're broken into municipalities. I think comparing to other states, otherwise quota states, not states that many states don't have a limit at all on liquor licenses. So I'm assuming he's just talking about quota states. But obviously a state with 25 million people is going to have a different ratio than a state with under 1 million people. But let me ask a quick question. How many breweries does Anchorage have? How many are allowed under current law? And how many would be allowed if this bill were to pass?
Through the chair, from what we understand, if I do my math correctly, it looks like Anchorage should hold 28 retail tasting rooms for breweries, 28 for distilleries, and 28 for wineries if SB9 were to become law. Currently, Anchorage, under current law, would allow 99 brewery tasting rooms, 99 distillery retail licenses, and 99 winery retail licenses.
Representative Wall.
Yeah, how many breweries does Anchorage have right now? How many breweries would be allowed? I guess under current law, you're saying there's 99 allowed. How many are there, and how many would be allowed under this proposed law?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Wall. That's kind of a challenge to answer right now because there's actually three that are in planning. That's the kind of in the midst of opening. But I can double check that number. I don't have the exact number right now, but I believe it's about eight breweries that are operating retail licenses, although it may have moved down to seven because I believe Eagle River Odd Man Rush actually moved to a BDL license recently. So I'm going to say seven, but I can get back to the committee with a more firm answer.
Thank you. Yeah. Senator Michiki.
Just to answer the last question, under 1 in 12,000, 25 would be allowed. There's eight or nine operating and a couple of looking to open. So it would be allow a 300% increase in the current tasting rooms, not breweries, because breweries will no longer be limited. Neither will distilleries or wineries. It's just the tasting rooms.
Anything further before invited testimony? Great, thank you. First, we have Tiffany Hall from Recover Alaska. Ms. Hall, welcome to House Finance. If you could please place yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much. My name is Tiffany Hall. I am the Executive Director of Recover Alaska, which is a statewide organization made up of leaders in health, safety, and prevention that works to reduce excessive alcohol use and harms across the state. Thank you so much, Co-Chair Merrick, and all the members of the committee for considering SB 9. And today I am in support of SB 9, testifying in support. We have been working on the content of SB 9 for many years, hand in hand with other public health and safety proponents, as well as with members of the industry at every level, and local and municipal and community leaders. Recover is not an abstinence-only organization, but as you likely know, Alaska struggles with many problems associated with alcohol. Alaskans are dying at rates well over twice as high as the rest of the nation. Alcohol costs our state $2.4 billion every year. In 2020, the leading cause of visitation to emergency departments were alcohol-related disorders for adults aged 18 to 64. SB 9 is full of positive policy changes that will help to change these statistics over time. It regulates the number and types of alcohol outlets, which is one of the most effective strategies for reducing the harms of alcohol, especially violent crime. SB 9 creates a regulation system for the internet sale of alcohol, which will mean taxes come in and no boxes of alcohol will be left on a doorstep, instead requiring an ID check. Currently, there is zero regulation of alcohol coming in from the lower 48. This bill restructures enforcement and adds licensee and social host liabilities, both of which are proven to reduce motor vehicle fatalities and to reduce underage drinking. It closes the loophole on server education, making sure that everyone who serves alcohol has undergone a safety training. And it increases license fees to give the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office more resources to do things like education for licensees and underage compliance checks, which stopped happening about 5 years ago when federal funding ran out. As was mentioned, alcohol is not an ordinary commodity. No other product comes with a multi-billion dollar price tag to our state. It requires a whole title to regulate it, and SB 9 keeps intact many ways to protect and promote business, while keeping in mind the necessary health and safety regulations. We've worked long and hard over the past 11 years with more than 120 stakeholders representing various sectors, issues, and regions of the state. We argued, we listened, and we worked together to find solutions that we can all agree on. The bill overall will be a huge win for the state of Alaska. I have sincere appreciation to Senator Michiki for his years of dedication to this issue and commitment to both financial and physical well-being of Alaskans. And thank you all again for your time and consideration, and I respectfully ask for you to please pass SB 9 as is.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Questions? Seeing none, we appreciate you being here. Next.
Madam Chair.
Representative LeBon.
Yes, thank you very much, and thank you for your testimony, Ms. Hall. And I guess my question is regarding a brewery tasting room.
And does that represent an equal public safety or public health concern versus, say, traditional bars or package stores?
Through the chair, thanks so much for that question, Representative Laban. And actually, I was just reading some more about that this very week. Some of the research is hard to tell, but I did see one particular study, and I'm happy to send you that citation afterwards, that actually said, it used a term that we don't have here, but essentially it was taverns, restaurants, and another term for breweries. I can send you the exact citation, but it did say that those are shown to have even more connection to both violent and nonviolent crime than, for example, a liquor store.
So to follow up then, brewery tasting room in a community represents as much or even a greater public health concern versus a traditional bar?
Thanks, through the chair. Thanks for that question. So as Lee Ellis mentioned, Alaska is one of very few states that have this tasting room model. And so I suspect that there is not peer-reviewed evidence specifically on the model of tasting rooms. However, I did reach out to the nation's leading expert, Dr. Pamela Trangenstein, who does all of her research on density and the number of alcohol outlets. And she said, an outlet is an outlet and alcohol is alcohol. And the more that we have of them, the more harms of alcohol we see in that community, not only from things like crime perpetrated by people who are actually in those establishments, but as well, the proliferation of alcohol outlets on every single corner really sends a message to our youth about the normalization and the social norms of alcohol. And the more that they see alcohol everywhere, the more likely they are to begin drinking earlier, and that also has some research behind it.
Yes, and thank you for that answer. Madam Chair, I don't know if a representative from the ABC board would like to attempt to answer that question regarding public health and safety at a brewery tasting room versus a traditional bar.
It looks like we have Dana Walkuchiewicz from the Alcohol Beverage Control Board online. Are you available?
Thank you. Thank you, Senator, or Representative Laban, there for your question. It's a great question. I would like to do some more research on that, see if we can correlate the instances of enforcement between taproom, the operation of taprooms versus BDLs or bars and restaurants. I don't have that information in front of me at this moment. It can be, I'd also would have to defer to local police departments to see what's if there is instances there which could corroborate any kind of type of, you know, a statement whether or not a tap room is more results in more disturbances or limitations within the public. I don't have that information in front of me right now. I cannot answer that question specifically.
Great, thank you. And for the record, could you state your name and affiliation, please?
This is Dana Walukowicz with the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. I am chairman of the Alcohol Beverage Control Board.
Thank you very much. Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, yeah, I guess this is as much an observation than a question for any of the presenters, that this bill seems to be targeting brewery tasting rooms as a big concern, limiting the number of licenses issued for that business purpose. And I'm just wondering, if alcohol is alcohol, then should licenses be limited to all types of alcohol serving, whether it's traditional bars or package stores or whatever? It just seems like the focus is on brewery tasting rooms, and it seems to be a little bit of a harsh focus. So that would be my comment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. A lot that Representative Laban said I want to comment on. I also have a question for Ms. Hall. But as far as the studying whether there's more police intervention at bars or taverns or at tasting rooms, I think is a little, predictable, in that bars are open till 1 in the morning. There's no drink limit. Culturally, they're a little different. That's like saying, are there more fights at the really high-end bar at the Hyatt Regency or at the little fishing pub on the dock? I mean, where's there going to be more police intervention? You know, one easily can guess. As far as population limits, to Representative LeBond's point, there are population limits for package store licenses, for BDLs, for restaurant eating place licenses, and for brewery tasting rooms. They're already on the books. And currently, except for the REPLs, they have the same population limit. I guess for Ms. Hall, my question is this, and I've asked you this in years past, and again, regard to brewery tasting rooms, because you and your organization seem to be behind the belief or the concept that alcohol is a detrimental, has detrimental effects on our society, and that the more of it there is, the more harm it would do. And I a couple years ago I said, and this was about the time that we were discussing tasting rooms, because the distillery tasting rooms were allowed in law in 2014, and the beer predated that a little bit. But it was basically adding new outlets, new venues where people could drink. And I asked you about it, and as it relates to Title IV, you said, well, that wasn't really a Title IV issue because that happened independently in statute. However, you made some comments that made me think that you may have changed your opinion on that, and I'm curious to see. Also, if the availability of alcohol could, you know, cause detrimental, have detrimental effects with regards to health and public safety, would expanding the hours of these tasting rooms also contribute to that effect? Also, because if they're open till 10, you could conceivably make a tour. You could go to 3 or 4 on a given evening from 5 to 10 o'clock and certainly become intoxicated beyond the limit at one place, which is 36 ounces of beer, 3 ounces of alcohol, some ounces of wine. I don't know what the wine limit is, but might be 18 or something. But do you think, is the addition of tasting rooms to our portfolio of alcohol outlets goes against your core belief that more alcohol is bad? And does expanding the hours of the tasting rooms also go against that core belief?
Through the chair, thanks for that question, Representative Wohl. And I think, so with regard to the addition of tasting rooms in general as positive or negative for Alaska, I think what I had intended to convey was that it's already part of statute, and so just like I'm not trying to undo allowing bars or liquor stores to exist, I'm not going to try to undo tasting rooms to exist. I think we would get even more pushback then. I do stand by what I said about just the more proliferation of alcohol in general, the worse in terms of both prevention and public health outcomes. And then in terms of the expanded hours, I'll have to refer back to Ms. Brawley, but I believe that it is not expanded hours. Is it expanded hours of serving or expanded hours of being open? Is one question that I have. And then in terms of research, one of the primary things I've seen that first comes to mind, but I'm happy to follow up on it, is just the idea of having multiple different closing times, just so that not every single alcohol outlet closes at the exact same time. Kind of this idea of like, we stop serving and we close our doors right now, and so then everyone pours out into the street. That's the one piece of research that immediately comes to mind as being not helpful to public health. But I'm happy to look for other research around these, around this expanded hours, but also I'm curious if it's hours of sale versus hours of actually being open.
Follow up?
I believe it's hours of service, not just being open. So right now you can't buy a beverage after 8 with this new bill. You can buy a beverage up till 10, but then they close it, hard close at 10. And don't get me wrong, I'm not anti-tasting room. I patronize them as well, so I don't think they're a bad influence in society. I worry about the business competition level playing field. Underage drinking is mentioned a lot as being a problem. We have a lot of provisions in this bill, keg registration, etc. Again, I'm not condoning underage drinking. I guess my question is underage drinking bad because the person is too young, you know, mentally or physically, or is it bad because it's breaking the law? Because, as I'm sure you know, out of the 190 countries in the world, the countries that have a 21 plus drinking age, I think there's 12. So we're definitely on the outlier. The large majority of them, or majority are 18, 19. Some are younger. There's a couple that are older, mostly Muslim countries, and also Muslim countries that ban it altogether. But of the 21 plus, we're definitely in the outlier. So most countries, Canada, Mexico, our two neighbors, most of Europe, South America, are all 18. So is the inherent risk of underage drinking to do with breaking the law, or is it to do with some sort of physiological mental development?
Through the chair, thanks so much for that question. It's a great question, and it is the second one. It is very much physiological. The human brain continues to develop until ages 22 to 25, and for a person who starts drinking under that age, a person who starts drinking by the age of 15 is 5 times more likely to develop an alcohol use disorder than not. And so actually, the international conversations that I'm a part of at the alcohol policy level are trying to get more and more countries to go to 21, and some countries are even looking to a little bit older than that, because our brains are still developing beyond that, and it is so much easier to create neural pathways that lead to addiction and misuse under that age.
Representative Wall.
Thank you. Does that mean that countries that have less than 21 have a lot more alcohol problems than we do? Because I believe Alaska has probably more problems than most states. And you can tell me, I know we have some horrible statistics, but do other countries have worse statistics than the U.S.? Because U.S. has been 21 plus for, I don't know, 40 years or so.
Through the chair, I don't know the answer to that in terms of numbers, but I also think that, again, culture plays a lot into it. And I know firsthand how alcohol is normalized and marketed here in the U.S. So I think that the strict number, the age number, is not the only factor that would play into the harms that we see here.
Great, thank you, Ms. Hall. We appreciate you being here. Next online, we have Sarah Oates from CHAR. Welcome back, Ms. Oates. If you could state your name, affiliation, and please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Oates, and I'm the President and CEO of Alaska CHAR, which is the state's nonprofit trade association for the hospitality industry, representing over 800 businesses statewide. I first would like to thank the committee for hearing the bill today. We have now entered the 11th year of robust stakeholder work toward meaningful, sensible alcohol regulatory reform, which I have been involved in since the beginning. I am very proud to say that through challenging yet thoughtful compromise, consensus on a complete draft was finally reached in 2019 between public health, public safety, state and municipal regulatory bodies, and all three industry tiers. That consensus remains today. Alaska CHAR proudly offers our support of Senate Bill 9, and I implore the committee to swiftly pass this vital legislation, as it will provide long-term regulatory certainty and desperately needed modernization for an industry that has taken some of the hardest financial hits due to the pandemic. We are now 2 years into this pandemic as of this week, as far as shutdowns for our businesses go, the initial shutdowns of the hospitality industry and other businesses, and liquor licensees have suffered devastating blows. Our constituency represents $2 billion of annual revenue into Alaska and over 32,000 employees. And in 2020 alone, our industry statewide experienced average revenue losses of 75% and only had 40% of their regular employee count actually working. Significant losses and hardships continue for our industry today, which I'm sure many of you have heard about, due to workforce shortages, supply chain disruptions, price increases, and delays in the distribution of federal relief. Senate Bill 9 includes significant changes to law that would benefit and support the industry in many ways. It provides funding and legal authority for online license applications, saving businesses months to years worth of time in processing delays and expensive attorney fees, which I'm sure Adam is familiar with, sorry, Representative Bull is familiar with. It creates clear, consistent, and fair penalties for violations, most of which would be monetary tickets, like $250 on average, rather than misdemeanor crimes. It mandates proactive education on laws and expectations by AMCO, as opposed to the longstanding system of education through enforcement. And by that I mean, in my experience in working with AMCO and now in representing the hospitality industry, many licensees don't understand some of the weird nuances of Title IV. The title itself is confusing and often contradictory in places, and they learn of it through receiving a notice of violation sometimes. The bill regulates internet sales, as you heard Nicole speak about, promoting more sales by Alaskan businesses and requiring out-of-state sellers to pay alcohol taxes as Alaska businesses do. It enables license stacking. In other words, manufacturers would be able to purchase retail licenses and vice versa, leveling the playing field with a pay-to-play type system regarding retail benefits. This enables the expansion of innovation and brewery business models while preserving the value of licenses held by restaurants, bars, and package stores. So I'm confident that every person in this meeting knows the owner of a restaurant, a bar, or a package store who has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to obtain a license that provides them with retail privileges and other privileges that come with that license, like the ability to provide entertainment. And so this bill allows for lots of innovation. It allows for manufacturers to purchase these retail licenses or to obtain new restaurant eating place licenses that expand their privileges for a very small fee. And while it would limit the tasting store or the tasting room model, the purpose behind that is to really help preserve the licenses, the secondary market value of the licenses that meant that over 1,500 businesses have purchased across the state. The bill also creates endorsements that allow for flexibility in business operations without creating more license types, which adds an added layer of protection to businesses' liquor licenses themselves. The beverage dispensary duplicate license model would go away. Instead, businesses would have a simplified, less expensive process to serve at multiple bars and stations. For example, some of you are probably familiar with 49th State Brewing Company, their location down on 3rd Street in Anchorage. They hold over half dozen licenses to cover all of their serving stations, and they pay fees for those licenses every other year. This bill would simplify that so that they would only have to renew one license, and then they would have an endorsement to cover the remaining service stations. The bill expands opportunities for package stores, including creating a new package store tasting event permit and sampling endorsement that would allow businesses to provide on-premises sampling to showcase their products. It creates a logical way for new restaurants to obtain licenses for beer and wine services in communities that serve larger populations, like cities within boroughs, or communities that provide tourism, which is most of Alaska, as we know. It removes the current clunky and broken petition process and converts current public convenience licenses to regular transferable licenses. Representative Thompson spoke about this earlier, was asking questions about this earlier. It enables golf courses that hold beverage dispensary licenses to serve a full bar across the golf course rather than being limited to beer and wine sales. So a golfer could bring her gin and soda out of the clubhouse to the golf cart and onto the course instead of having to finish it in the clubhouse or instead of having to go buy a beer. And a number of courses across Alaska, including in Fairbanks, are very interested in this change. And it also enables up to 3 package store licenses per decade to be relocated to other cities and areas within a borough. So for example, if Costco wanted to open a store in Wasilla, it could purchase a license anywhere within the MAPC borough and then transfer it to within Wasilla city limits, which it cannot do today. So as you've heard today, and we'll hear when you receive public testimony, Senate Bill 9 includes many changes that would benefit all sectors and stakeholders, and it gives our industry some hope that we can overcome some of the ongoing challenges move forward with a better regulatory system, and again, thrive as part of Alaska's second largest industry. Thank you all for your time and consideration, and respectfully ask that you advance this bill as written to the House floor as soon as possible.
Thank you, Ms. Oates. Next, with the Brewers Guild of Alaska, we have Representative Wohl.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Hi, Sarah. I was just wondering, you mentioned 800 businesses that you represent. Is there any requirement to join CHAR? Do you have to have a beverage license or some kind of manufacturing license?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, you have to own a restaurant, a bar, a retail store, or some other hospitality-type business, a hotel, that operates in the state of Alaska in order to be an active voting member of CHAR. You do not need to hold a liquor license.
Follow-up?
Yeah, and if you don't know, that's fine, and maybe you can get back to me, but just out of your 800, how many are license holders? And you can get back to me if you don't know that number off the top of your head.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I don't know that exact number, but I believe it's over 90%.
Thank you. I see nothing further. Thank you, Ms. Oates, for being with us. Next, with the Brewers Guild of Alaska, we have Lee Ellis. Mr. Ellis, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, Lee Ellis, president of Midnight Sun Brewing Company and board president of Brewers Guild of Alaska. First, I just want to thank the committee today for hearing this bill. It's a huge project that we've been working on for a long time. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 9 and to hopefully answer some important questions that have come up lately and clarify some misunderstandings about how Senate Bill 9 will affect the brewing industry in Alaska. I'd like to provide some context for the committee and the legislature today to help frame the picture of why Senate Bill 9 is a significant improvement for brewers, wineries, and distilleries. When the craft beverage industry began in Alaska, we had very little access to the broader retail market, very few options to sell on premise. In the late 2000s, the legislature changed Title IV to allow manufacturers to sell a restricted quantity of products on premise in response to changing marketplace demand for consumers. So the manufactured tasting rooms are popular with the public. They're a very uncommon retail license model nationally. Throughout most of the country, manufacturers commonly have access to full liquor licenses as well as beer and wine licenses, labeled as BDLs and REPLs in Alaska. Manufacturers in Alaska may operate a brew pub with a BDL or REPL license currently. However, those licenses under current law have very strict production, wholesale, and retail limitations. Brewers Guild commissioned a study in 2019 to better understand production, sales, and impact of Alaska craft brewers. The study found that brewery tasting rooms rarely sold over 500 barrels, one barrel being 31 U.S. gallons, on-premise, while brewers operating brew pub model commonly sold 2,000 barrels or more on-premise. While tap rooms have been popular, only 3% of the beer produced in Alaska was sold through a tap room in 2019. 89% was sold to wholesalers and retailers. The remainder was sold on-premise at brew pubs. Nationally, brew pubs account for 40% of breweries operating in the U.S., while in Alaska they only account for less than 20%. Breweries that are currently operating have grown in spite of a highly restricted market, while brewers that open in the future will have vastly more options to choose from in how they operate and retail their products. While the potential number of tasting rooms may be more limited in the future, many manufacturers report that they will move to REPL and BDL licenses in order to grow their businesses and fully maximize their retail space. The economic opportunity of holding a full retail license and no longer having our production and distribution caps ultimately with manufacturers have expired for 25 years. Furthermore, under Senate Bill 9, there will be no more caps on the number of manufacturers. Currently, communities such as Palmer, Valdez, Haines, Homer, Cordova, Soldotna, Delta Junction, Craig, and Skagway cannot have any more breweries. If Senate Bill 9 passes, those communities will be able to host more manufacturing operations. It's also important to know that numerous brewers would rather not host retail operations. However, trade practices that are federally legal but not enforced in Alaska have been a huge barrier to brewers trying to sell their products in the retail market, thus forcing manufacturers into the tasting room model as a way to get their products to the consumer. SB9 will outlaw these unfair trade practices and help manufacturing models become economically viable. The compromise involving manufacturer retail licenses is a response numerous stakeholders regarding the explosion of retail points for alcohol both diluting the market and creating significant public health issues. Our industry strives for 35 years to be good neighbors, support our communities, promote responsible consumption, and recognize that a balanced regulatory environment is good for everyone. We support the compromises requested by the public health sector. These positions are evidence-based because our industry wants to help reduce the harms to alcohol created in our community. We respect the position of our alcohol industry members. The state created a limited entry system decades ago that resulted in significant secondary value for limited license holders. While the Guild isn't particularly supportive of that system, simply undoing it would in fact rob thousands of small business-owning Alaskans of their life savings. So while we are free market believers, we also recognize the potential consequence of pursuing our philosophical beliefs legislatively. The brewing industry in Alaska is built on manufacturers developing relationships with our community. Our goal today isn't to get all we can for brewers, do what's right for Alaska as a whole. Support our neighbors, and they're willing to make sacrifices to make sure everyone is treated equitably. SB 9 is good for all of Alaska, and no special interest in particular. The opportunities for existing, in-planning, and future manufacturers will expand significantly under Senate Bill 9. The experienced manufacturers know that increasing population caps on manufacturer retail licenses will have a minimal effect on the growth of our industry. The actual math of potential licensees shows that after passage of Senate Bill 9, Alaska could become host to the highest density of breweries and distilleries per capita in the world. The only real limitations for our industry after the passage of Senate Bill 9 simply be the economics. I'd like to thank the committee for their time and respectfully request this committee to pass Senate Bill 9. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ellis. We appreciate you being with us today. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And Mr. Ellis, I couldn't hear some of what you said because it's a little distorted. As far as population caps, can you state the reason why you support raising the population number for brew pub tasting rooms? I couldn't hear that.
Through the chair, I think Representative Wohl and myself are both having a hard time hearing each other. If you could repeat the question, I'd be happy to answer it. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. I couldn't hear the reason you're talking about population limits and caps. What is you or your organization's reason for supporting the 12,000 cap, population cap for brew pub tasting rooms or brewery tasting rooms?
Through the chair, again, I'm still having challenges hearing, but I think you're asking me why we're supportive of raising the caps. Is that correct, Representative Wolf, through the chair? Am I hearing the question correctly?
Yes.
Okay. Through the chair, the Brewers Guild, I would say, is not supportive of raising caps so much as we are supportive of this agreement. There is a lot of context to how we got to the point we got to today. And what was considered early on was a retail license for manufacturers in full with a lower population cap. And that would mean that a brewery or winery or distillery would all apply for that same retail license. The Brewers Guild was not supportive of that system out of concern that breweries would eat up all those licenses and our communities would not be have the opportunity to host distilleries and wineries. So the reason we do support this is that this allows every community to have a winery, a brewery, and a distillery. And again, we've gone through the math on this, and we know that breweries are going to be able to continue to expand throughout the state. But the biggest thing is that the tasting room model was created so that brewers had a place to refill their product, because we could only use the BDL model, but in a very limited sense, and the RAPL model, and not be able to sell any beer outside of our doors. Now that we can access these other retail license types, that means that brewers who want to focus on selling their beer on premise will have a better access to that market. So I want to say that the tap room, while it has been excellent to help breweries grow, there will be much more opportunity for breweries to expand in the future with these new available retail models.
Representative Wohl.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for that answer, Mr. Ellis. And in your experience, the breweries that are opening now in the last, 10 years, Do most of them have, are there many breweries opening that don't have a tasting room? I know, I mean, your brewery's a pretty big one. There's a few others. Do most breweries have tasting rooms? Certainly, even Alaskan Brewing has a tasting room. Are there many big breweries that don't have a tasting room, that don't, say, already have a BDL or a brew pub license? Like, do you know of any breweries that don't serve beer?
Yes, through the chair, to answer your question, Representative Wohl, there are three breweries currently operating that do not do any sort of on-premise retail activity.
And follow up?
Yes, follow up.
And there'd be three out of, I think the total state number is around 70, is that correct, in the state, 70 breweries and brew pubs combined?
Mr. Ellis?
Again, through the chair, I am so sorry. I'm having a real challenge hearing Representative Wohl, but I don't know if he was asking about the total number, but if you could ask the question again, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you. You said three don't sell beer, and I indicate there's between breweries and brew pubs, there's about 70, 68 or 70. Is that your number as well?
Through the chair, again, I believe you're asking a question between brew pubs and tasting rooms. I think what you're looking for is there's 41 tasting rooms, or 41 breweries currently operating, 38 with tap rooms, and then I believe the other 12 with EDL or EPL license. 53 total operating today.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Ellis. We appreciate you being with us today. Our final invited testimony is Glenn Klinkhart from the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. If you could state your name, affiliation, and please begin your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, again, this is Glenn Klinkhart. I'm the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Board, and I want to thank you all for your time and for your questions. I would like to start off by answering Representative Thompson's very good question earlier that he had asked about the violation of people who have licenses that have restrictions, i.e. that red line. And the answer, is actually a little more complicated, but it has to do with how and why that person has that restriction on their license. But as for the penalty question that he was specifically asking, the penalties can range from loss of that license to suspension of other time that they have over their head. They can also be fined. They could also have an A misdemeanor charge additionally put on top of that. And apparently a licensee can also civilly go after that person for essentially coming into their establishment trying to buy. So I hope Representative Thompson that helps him with that answer.
Thank you. Anything further?
Yes, I'd just like to add, and certainly one of the things that people don't always fully understand about the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office is that I actually work for the ABC board and the Marijuana Board, and so it's always been one of those things where I've been kind of happy to help work with my board, and my board has been very, very supportive of this bill. They have gone through it. They have every year they have voted to support it. They did it again this last year with SB9. The one thing that I do feel comfortable being able to speak to, and that is, as a law enforcement officer myself, the thing that I really am impressed about is that this bill gives enforcement, not just my enforcement officers across the state, but also state troopers and local officers, the ability to be able to use more tools that are more appropriate for the situation. I always joke that I give more warnings than I do tickets. That's because oftentimes a warning is more appropriate and will get people to fall into compliance. And so we at AMCO, I really like the fact that we have these other options of being able to have a fine, a small fine, that can essentially bring somebody back into compliance. And if it happens again, well, then we're going to be taking it to the board. And that whole idea of progressive discipline really, really works, because basically what I was given when I started here 2.5 years ago was all I was given was a hammer. And a hammer doesn't work, especially some cops. If you give us a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so we've worked to create more of a community-based enforcement program, and these changes give my officers and officers across the state the ability to use an appropriate punishment where appropriate. And yes, for those people who are going to put our children at risk, are going to overserve and put the public at risk, those are serious, and those are still going to be there, and those tools are going to be available. So again, I thank you, and if there's any questions, I will certainly be happy to answer them as best I can. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klinkhart. We appreciate your testimony. I see no questions. With that, we will take one final question from Representative Lebon, and then give Senator Machicki a chance for wrap-up, and then we'll move on to our next bill. Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess it's maybe more a statement than a question, but if somebody wishes to weigh in on the bill sponsor or any of the folks calling in to testify, I just have a sense that this bill is attempting to, goal, or at least a primary goal, to limit the number of brewery with tasting rooms. And I realize that there are population limits for all types of alcohol licenses, be it traditional bars or package stores, whatever it might be. But I just have a sense that the extreme limits on population going from 3,000 to 12,000 is targeting the breweries with the tasting rooms. And if somebody wants to comment on that sense, then I would welcome it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Lebon. I'm really glad that you led off with that. You said it earlier, and I'm glad you repeated it. If you remember a couple of years ago, so first of all, I'm a brewery guy. I'm not a brewery guy. I'm a tasting room guy. I happen to go to a tasting room called Kenai River Brewing. It's that's where I go. That's what I favor for a lot of reasons. So I've said from the beginning, I don't think these are the same people, and people can disagree with it. I think we can prove it. They're not the same people. It's a kind of rising tide floats all boats kind of thing. There are people that go to tasting rooms. There are people that go to bars. Sometimes, a couple times a year, people might go to both. But your statement I find interesting. Here's the reason. I don't think that you're doing what you think you're doing by being concerned with the 1 in 12,000. And I understand your objective, Representative Lebon. I think that's different than others, with others that are talking about the tasting room limit of 1 in 12,000. But I think you're doing the opposite of what you want to do. And here's why. Here's how it got to 1 in 12,000. Here's how it got to the deal. It got to the deal because, remember, it's a business model. It's only been around about 20 years. It was hard fought by the traditional licensees because they didn't want competition. So we brought these folks to the table. Tasting rooms became legal. It was 36 ounces, got to be closed by 8 p.m. Can't have any fun. There was a reg package trying to define not having fun a couple of years ago. That was promoted by traditional licensees. So they all started talking. There's a group of people that had a very difficult time sort of getting along. They started talking about, okay, how are we going to do this? So this other business type selling alcohol that happened to be brewers, distillers, and wineries, how can we allow them to expand their opportunities in a way that makes them successful? But yet we still kind of know they're not bars. If they want to operate a little bit more like a bar, they're going to have a limit. The more they want, the tighter the limit is going to be. Now, remember, they agreed to this because of all of the things they get. So, Representative Lebon, when you talk about this bill seems to you, let me tell you how this bill seems to me. I could open a little tasting room. Because I've had 2 years to apply under 1 in 3,000. 2 years. I don't know of many in the works right now. There's only 31 statewide because the number Representative Wool gave was for other models that are not limited at 1 in 12,000. So you got 30 tasting rooms around a state twice the size of Texas. There's significant room to expand in most communities under 1 in 3,000 for the next 2 years. But after that, when we hit the 1 in 12,000, the 1 in 3,000 are grandfathered, but there's so many other options. So you can move into a BDL and decide that you're going to be a brewery that doesn't have the limitations on time. You can move into an REPL. You can move into a brew pub license. The tasting room license is a very limited license type. If you want to blow your business out of the water, you know, look at all these other options that are available to you today. And once you move into one of those other options, it opens up your tasting room option to someone else if you're capped in your community. Most likely there's not someone waiting for it, or they'd be applying today. So I want you to look at the big picture, because I'm hearing lots of little picture comments. I don't mean that negatively. I had the same reaction when we had the first discussion. But remember, I yanked my bill after 12,000 hours of work with a very large group when people tried to hurt the breweries, tried to restrict them further. You might remember that, some of you guys around here. I killed the bill after all that work. I brought it back. We went back to the team and said, how can you come together as a team on expanding opportunities for breweries, distilleries, and wineries so they can succeed? People are voting with their feet. How can we do that and still not have a brewery on every corner? So this was the solution. That's why it's a compromise. But it's a great compromise. It's filled with all kinds of brilliant solutions that didn't exist, do not exist today. That's how we got here. So I appreciate the opportunity to answer. We're going to get something to you that explains all these options. So I know people keep looking at the tasting room issue without taking all the other issues into consideration. They're significant.
Thank you. Briefly, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, and appreciate that answer, Senator Machicki, to Representative LeBond's question. Mike, in terms of the other options that people have to expand their business, me not being familiar with what those licenses, what the fees would require, is the bar, when you try to expand your license into these other options, does the bar greatly raised because of the financial commitment that would require to go to these other options?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I can't believe I did that again. With a name like mine, you'd think I'd know. Yes, this bill is designed to create a collaboration between the different license types without significantly devaluing already existing expensive other license types. So if you want your tasting room to be a bar, you can now buy a BDL. You can become a bar. It expands what they can currently do by expanding hours, not the amount they can serve. So today, you can go in at 7:59, order the same three beers, which is the max, and sit there till 2 in the morning if they're open that late. Most are open later than they want to be. If this passes, you can order at 9:50, but you better drink fast if you're getting the 36 ounces, because you have to be out by 10, right? So there's some additional authorizations and activities that can occur in tasting rooms, but all these other pieces were the things that the other sides gave, trying to say, okay, no, here's what we're willing to kind of negotiate under this license type, but we're also willing to kind of share what we're doing. If you want to be a bar, then you can become a bar. But these are the limits of kind of what you can do as a tasting room. And in that exchange is where they came up with the 1 in 12,000. So some people fighting the expansion out in the different communities already have a monopoly under 1 in 3,000. But all these other activities won't be allowed. So in Homer, for instance, there are two. They're at their cap. Those two own a monopoly, only they can't go buy a BDL, or someone else can't, and become a brewery in that community that has a tasting room. Under this bill, it would allow that competition. And remember, this removes the cap on breweries, distilleries, and wineries that exist today that don't have a tasting room. So it expands another business line as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Final comment, please. Representative Wolf.
Final comment. I appreciate all that, Senator Michiki, and thank you, Madam Co-Chair. You said move into a BDL, and now there's no cap on breweries. I would put forward that to open a brewery or a distillery in Alaska right now, most of them are going to have a tasting room because that's a big source of revenue for them. Some of them make a lot of money on their tasting room, more so than wholesale. And if you didn't have that retail and only wholesale, I think it would be very difficult. And if you had a brewery without a tasting room, and you say, well, let's move into a BDL so I can sell drinks. In Juneau, that's $300,000. Anchorage is about the same. And they have to be available. I think there's only 10 in Juneau. And if there's not one available, you can't just move in. I support the being able to buy the BDL or the REPL if you're a tasting room, because then you can stay open later and have more offerings. But I think if that's going to be available, expanding into the other mission of a bar and what a bar is allowed to do with live music and staying open later, I think that's mission creep. You say you go to breweries and not to bars, and you know, most people are one or the other, and I'm not so sure I agree with that. I go to both. I have a lot of friends that go to both, and so I think there is a transition between one and the other, and I think moving into BDL is not so easy. It's very expensive, and I think limiting tasting rooms helps those that are in business now in the tasting room business, but doesn't help those that want to be in the tasting room business in the future that don't want to buy a BDL and can't afford one.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Michiki, in wrap up.
Yeah, thank you. You can't have it both ways. There's already creep. There's already tasting rooms. That was creep. So we've already made that decision. Here's the bottom line. Licenses are expensive. So licensees are worried about that competition from someone who doesn't have to buy a $40,000 to $300,000 license, depending on where you live. That's not really my point. We're not near the cap around most parts of the state, and where we're at a 1 in 3,000, we're already at a 1 in 3,000 with no additional opportunities for those folks. I just have a dream of where we're going to expand opportunities for Alaskans that want to brew really good beer and perhaps buy an REPL. There's a piece in this bill where municipalities can apply for additional REPLs to the board and expand an opportunity there. If they become successful, I can tell you right now, I know what some people have spent on their brewery operations and their brew pub operations, and some of them would be very willing to purchase. Yeah, it's rare, but will be willing to purchase an expensive BDL to expand their business further. I don't think we should feel like we can tie what someone's willing to spend on their business to expand it. Some folks become remarkably successful, and $300,000 in a couple million dollar building and brewing facility is a reasonable expenditure. So I think it kind of satisfies all those worries on the competition, on what brewers felt while it was a squashing their growth opportunities in the future. It's a very unique collection of where people compromised on something that can be remarkably successful. But tying it only to a tasting room, in my view, for the industry, is a mistake. I think there is far more opportunity out there available to under this bill that I think it's one of those things folks will look back a couple years from now, 5 years from now, and say, that worked. That was amazing. My favorite brewery expanded into this other thing, and I'm really pleased that Adam and Peter battled it out and came to the right solution.
Thank you, Senator Michiki. With that, we will be at ease until 3:16.
House Finance back on the record at 3:16 p.m. Next, we're doing House Bill 149 by Representative Fields. We heard this bill on March 8th, and amendments were due to my office Wednesday the 16th at 5 p.m. We have two amendments before the committee today. Welcome back, Representative Fields. Any opening comments before we move to amendments?
No, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Zach Fields, happy to address the amendments as they come up.
Great, thank you very much. And with that, we have amendment number one from Representative Rasmussen. Representative Rasmussen, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, I move amendment number one.
I'll object for purpose of discussion. Representative Rasmussen.
Amendment number one just makes it abundantly clear that an employee or child care provider does not have to become a member of an organization that represents child care providers. This amendment simply provides the workers with a choice, and I would ask for the members' support on the amendment.
Thank you. Any questions or comments on amendment number one?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
My question is, through the chair, what the sponsor thinks of the amendment.
Thanks, through the chair, to Representative Josephson. I did work on this amendment with Representative Rasmussen. It's important to remember what we're proposing here is a sectoral bargaining model where the entire sector negotiates with the state. Under a sectoral model, I don't think that we should require that individual employees or center owners be required to be a member of a union if the sector creates a union. It should be an opt-in model. I think we should maintain our current labor relations with respect to all the other private sector organizations that are out there. That's an enterprise-based bargaining model. But in sectoral bargaining, we don't need any degree of coercion. So I think this language is good because it tells providers it is entirely up to you whether you affiliate with a union should the sector decide to create a union. And of course, it's the sector's choice. So I do support the amendment.
Follow up.
I want to be sure I understand this fully. I assume that members who do join an organization would pay some sort of dues.
Correct. Through the chair.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
And if benefits inure to non-members, the non-members would enjoy those benefits at no cost to themselves, correct?
Through the chair, not necessarily. So let's say the entire step number one is the entire sector votes on whether they even want to engage in sectoral bargaining. Let's say a majority of participating voters in the sector vote yes. They decide to bargain sectorally. Next, they will form a union, again, of both employees and employers who are bargaining with the state. When they do that, in a practical matter, what they will do is shop around for a union that wants to work with them. Let's say it is SEIU as it is in many other states. Participating employers and employees might like SEIU's healthcare plan, for example. They might think that's a good deal, and they might want to reap those benefits. But if there's a small provider, maybe they have a spouse in the armed services and they don't need health care. That mom and pop stay at home provider who already has health care might opt out of being a part of this union that negotiates with the state. You know, each provider is different, and I think there are a lot of benefits in sectoral bargaining because it gives the sector a voice. But we can achieve those public policy benefits of empowering the sector without coercing individual providers or employees from joining that sectoral bargaining structure.
Representative Josephson.
Sorry, it's been a long week. Representative Fields, I know more about probably labor unions than most legislators, but there are 60 of us. I think you know a lot more than I do. But this is sort of a critical issue, is it not, in terms of whether there would be a ULP, an unfair labor practice, and whether someone would get attorney's privileges for free because they were in the SEIU, and
yep.
I mean, this is the, if we're going to have everyone buy in, this is the organic moment. So I want to make sure that you're comfortable with this amendment.
Through the chair, I'm not just comfortable. I asked Representative Rasmussen to introduce. I think it's important to remember, for most parts of our economy, we have what's called enterprise-based bargaining, an individual company and a union, which are partners sometimes and maybe adversaries when they negotiate over a CBA. I think within that enterprise-based bargaining, I do not support a right-to-work model because it enables free riders. In a sectoral bargaining context, which is what this bill enables, I don't think you have the same problems associated with free riders. And because this is a new idea for the sector And because it's a diverse sector, I don't think it's appropriate to require individuals to be a member of a union if the sector chooses to engage in sectoral bargaining. I think there are advantages that employers and employees will find in having more of a voice with the state, and I think that they will choose to engage in it when those benefits are worth the corresponding costs. And certainly, like you said, some of those benefits might include good legal support, healthcare, training, all those good things, but we do not need to coerce them, and I do support the amendment.
Thank you. For the record, Representative Fields, SEIU.
SEIU is Service Employees International Union, and that is the union that represents child care providers in some of the other states that have gone to the sectoral bargaining model.
Thank you. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So based on what you just said, sectoral bargaining in other states, SEIU, this type of amendment would be in their laws as well.
Representative Wohl, it's actually because domestic work is excluded from the National Labor Relations Act, we as a state have a choice of whether we require union membership or not when we establish the sectoral bargaining framework. So it's entirely our choice. I think because this is a new thing in the sector and we want the sector to be able to enter into it gracefully and have full support, it's really important that we allow people to opt in.
Thank you. Anything further on amendment number one? Seeing none, Representative Rasmussen, and wrap up.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This amendment, I feel, really reinforces the intent of the legislature. I wanted to be sure that people felt comfortable that we weren't forcing anybody into the sectorial bargaining agreement and not have to participate in order to be able to receive state child care assistance still. So it was really important to me. I appreciate the bill sponsor for working with my office on this, and I would just ask for member support.
Great, thank you. With that, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, Amendment 1 has been adopted. That takes us to Amendment Number 2 by Representative Josephson. Representative Josephson?
I move Amendment 2.
I'll object for discussion. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment before you creates a trust fund to implement the sectorial bargaining agreement that we would enable by this bill. And I would, with your permission, invite the sponsor to speak to the amendment.
Representative Fields.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks to Representative Josephson for offering this amendment. Since I introduced this bill over a year ago and we started hearing it in Labor and Commerce, we really had a sea change in terms of circumstances, namely an oil revenue windfall that has provided us with an opportunity to not only establish a sectoral bargaining framework, but actually contemplate a structure to start injecting meaningful public investment in the child care sector. I think as House Bill 149 has progressed through the process, and as we have heard input from businesses, parents, child care providers, two things are clear. Number one, the child care sector needs more power in negotiating with the state. Sectoral bargaining does that. Number two, we are never going to be able to have an adequately sized workforce to provide the supply of child care we need at prices parents can afford unless we have meaningful public investment. The amendment before you establishes a child care trust fund. This is a model that is used in other states. New Mexico recently established one. And the way it would work is if we adopt this policy language, we would have an opportunity to capitalize such a fund, which could be managed under an endowment model. I think the history of our state's finances show that we have wild swings in revenue. And when we have significant windfall revenue, we should contemplate setting some of it aside to pay out long-term benefits. That is the proposal. Of course, it's a separate question how much money the legislature might appropriate into a fund, but I think it's really important to have that structure. And, you know, just to give you an example, if the legislature were to, I know that there's a lot of interest in putting some of our windfall revenue into savings. The trust fund is a mechanism of savings. If we were to appropriate money into that and pay it out at a 5% rate, it could be the largest investment in the child care sector that our sector has ever seen. I think we've heard a need for that. And I would just note, we did have a hearing that discussed this proposal in a lot of detail at the Labor and Commerce Committee on Wednesday. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation addressed the dire need for intervention in the child care sector and addressed in a lot of detail some of the questions Representative Johnson asked about at the previous committee hearing. We heard from multiple organizations in support of a child care trust fund, including THRED, and including Growing Alaskan Leaders. We heard testimony from parents who said they're having to drop out of the workforce because they can't afford childcare. One of Anchorage's business leaders has an op-ed in the ADN that just published today in support of a child care trust fund. So I think there's just a lot of energy among parents and child care providers that we need to address this crisis in child care, and the trust fund amendment is a really critical way to do that. So I appreciate the member, or I appreciate Representative Jessen offering this amendment.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, amendment number 2 has been adopted. We have no other amendments before the committee. Are there any other comments, discussion, questions on House Bill 149?
Madam Co-Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And through the chair, I just wanted to say that I think this bill has a lot of merit, and I really do think that allowing people to have the option to decide to participate or not is a good thing, but we all obviously have a need to look at our child care practices here in the state and see what we can do to grow our options and availability for child care, as it is oftentimes it's a pretty big barrier for workers, and we know we all have a workforce shortage. So I appreciate this bill coming forward, and I support moving it out of committee.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Any further questions or comments? Seeing none, Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 149, version 32-LS0474/A from committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection?
Object.
Representative Johnson.
I'm not interested in speaking to my objection. I just wanted to put it on the record.
Thank you. Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll?
Yes.
Representative Ortiz?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Merritt?
Yes. Did we poll Representative Rasmussen? Pardon, thank you very much for that. And with a vote of 7 yeas, 6 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 149 is moved from committee. Thank you, brief at ease. Back on the record, we will have a brief introduction from Representative Hopkins today on his bill, House Bill 289, Marijuana Industry Task Force.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Greyer Hopkins, representing Esther, Goldstream, Steese, Farmers Loop, Birch Hill, and Downtown Fox. And with me today is my staffer, Joe Hardenbrook. Thank you for hearing House Bill 289. This bill will establish the Alaska Marijuana Industry Task Force to create a holistic look at our state's growing marijuana industry, analyze its strengths and weaknesses, and propose a package of reforms. These proposed reforms would then be submitted to the Marijuana Control Board, the governor, and the legislature in January of 2023, and then disband. The legislature or anybody would be able to take up those recommendations that result from the task force. This industry is a uniquely Alaskan one. State law requires that license holders be Alaska residents, resulting in an Alaska marijuana industry owned and operated by Alaskans. Additionally, many business owners are struggling to comply with the letter and spirit of the law, and several factors, including the taxation, licensing, and enforcement, continue to challenge the industry today. In your bill packet are a number of Anchorage Daily News articles highlighting many of those issues. We can and should ensure that local governments also continue to play a strong role in authorizing, monitoring, and generating revenue for their local governments from this new industry. Further, make no mistake that these solutions do have problems, or sorry, there are solutions to these problems, but they involve give and take and compromise amongst members of the industry, state regulators, and local governments. In order to pursue a strategy that strengthens these Alaska businesses while protecting local control, HB 289 proposes that this task force review the issue, develop ideas for industry reform, utilize state resources to model how the changes would impact the businesses and local governments. And additionally, I think it's also fitting that the fiscal note and the cost borne for this 6 month or so long task force are done entirely by license receipts from Alaska's marijuana industry utilizing no general fund dollars. At this point, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hardenbrook, my staff, to walk the committee through the bill unless there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hardenbrook.
Chair Merrick, members of the committee, for the record, Joe Hardenbrook, Office of Representative Hopkins. Quickly, how will this task force operate? The selection process for the members of the task force has been crafted to ensure representation, expertise, and geographic diversity. The task force will be chaired by the chair of the Marijuana Control Board. The two state agencies most closely involved in Alaska's marijuana industry, the Departments of Commerce and Revenue, will be represented by their commissioners or their designees. Because so many of these questions are economic in nature, we've reserved a seat for an economist from the University of Alaska. Because the voter initiative carved out specific roles and rights for local governments, we've included three municipal government representatives with a requirement that those officials come from different judicial districts and represent the breadth of Alaska's local governments, cities, and boroughs. Because those most affected by a decision should have a role in making that decision, we reserved three seats, a quarter of the task force's membership, for representatives of the Alaska marijuana industry. Like the local government seats, these task force members must hail from different judicial districts and represent the breadth of industry, cultivators, processors, and retailers. The governor will appoint a member representing public health interests. Finally, there are two legislative seats in the hopes that the input and advice of legislators can help craft a final product with a greater chance of enactment. As Representative Hopkins mentioned, this task force is not a permanent creation. Rather, the task force must meet four times over the interim, conduct their work, craft their proposals, model their data, and submit their findings to the executive and legislative branches for consideration and potential action. This legislation does not create a new permanent position, but rather relies on a temporary position to assist the task force in crafting its final product. The findings of the task force are, first and foremost, non-binding. They are not limited to suggestions for legislative fixes. Suggestions may include statutory, regulatory, and administrative changes. A top-down, one-size-fits-all solution to this complex issue will most likely result in additional challenges to the industry and may cause unforeseen circumstances which compound problems instead of rectifying them. As we've repeatedly heard from representatives of resource development activities in Alaska as well as other businesses, fiscal certainty and good data are essential components of any successful business enterprise. And to reiterate what Representative Hopkins mentioned, the cost of these efforts will be borne by program receipts and licensing fees from Alaska's marijuana industry. The cost of this task force will be paid for by the Alaskans who've invested in Alaska's marijuana industry. Chair Merrick, two amendments were adopted by the Labor and Commerce Committee. One change moves the proposed task force from in-person meetings to remote video conference meetings, resulting in a substantial savings in travel and lodging costs. Another amendment added a public health seat to the task force. We can dispense with going through the sectional analysis. This is a two-section bill, if you'd like. And I just know for the committee that we have Glenn Klinkhart, Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, online for questions about the fiscal note. Thank you, and I'll conclude my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Hardenbrook. Mr. Klinkhart, if you could place yourself on the record and present the fiscal note. It looks like it's control code ZIBYW.
Thank you very much. Again, for the record, this is Glenn Klinkhart. I am the Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. Let me pull this particular one up. There we go. Basically, I mean, I don't think that for the sake of the committee, I'm going to read the whole thing, but basically, as has been mentioned, that this is designed to, the board itself is going to be basically just a part of this much larger group of this task force. My office has agreed to basically be kind of the conduit to be able to support it. In order to do that, we've asked specifically for about $52,000 for a long-term non-perm project assistant, who is going to be able to help assist with the meetings, do the research, compile it, kind of be that person to kind of bring everything together. We've reduced the travel down to a very bare minimum, as well as services, mainly because we've had very, very good experience because of COVID doing our marijuana and alcohol board meetings remotely using Zoom, which is really a very good thing. The other part of this, as was mentioned, is that we believe that looking at our budget, AMCO itself is actually one of the few places in the state that I don't have to come to you every year and ask for money, because we are supported by receipts. And oftentimes in the last several years, we've actually given money back to the general fund. So there's enough there, we believe, to be able to support this particular bill under this fiscal note. If there's any specific questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I think the only thing I would like to add to this is that the idea of having this task force, from our perspective, is that the Marijuana Control Board is a licensing board. They're not a legislative arm. They provide licenses for those who meet the statutes. We do enforcement, as we've talked about with the ABC. The larger issues are oftentimes not dealt with because we're just trying to deal with the day-to-day issues of keeping the industry, making sure the public's safe, and doing those things. Although the Marijuana Board has actually had some special meetings just to talk about these bigger things like licensing caps and taxation, some of these things, but it's really not within their purview. That the industry has spoken and has indicated that they want to be able to have these discussions and be able to come up with ideas. And frankly, when this was brought to my attention, I said we really do have to support it, because there's no way that they're going to be able to get from point A to point B without having something else. My board is not the place directly to be able to handle that. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klinkhart. Questions on the fiscal note? Seeing none, questions or comments on House Bill 289? Representative Wohl?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. As long as we're allowing time for questions and comments, I will take advantage of that. I applaud the efforts of the bill sponsor and staff, and I this is an issue. I've had a few, more than one constituent approach me about the marijuana tax situation right now and how they are having a hard time, because it's a flat tax of $800 per pound. And initially, when the marijuana business started in Alaska, the wholesale price was about $5,000 a pound. And now it is closer to $2,000 a pound. So they're paying close to 40% tax. So I'm glad this task force will be created, hopefully. I think it's an issue that needs addressing. I guess my only comments and or questions would be, we just heard from the alcohol group, the alcohol bill, Title IV, that's been in the works for 10 or 12 years or more. They have an industry group, they have a stakeholders group, a lot of people at the table, and it gets complicated, and you know, it's hard to get that many people to agree. You have 13 people. Basically, I think you're just dealing with the tax issue, or is there other issues beyond that? Because I guess at first glance, it seems like a lot of people, and that's my concern. And not to say they're not all great people and can bring something to the table, but it's just a big table, and that would be my concern. I say there's a public health person. I know there's a public health person on the marijuana board. I know there's a public health person on the alcohol board for obvious reasons. The consumption of these items can lead to health issues and is a health concern. But I think we're dealing here with just taxes, am I not mistaken? And you have economists and people in the industry. So I'm just concerned that this is a little big.
Representative Hopkins.
I don't know if you have comments on that.
Representative Wohl, through the chair. Thank you for the comments. Thank you for the question. The task force, as envisioned, would address primarily the economic side of the concerns here. As you mentioned, the wholesale tax of $800 a pound does incentivize and disincentivize certain behaviors within the industry. And that's one of the things that we're hoping to do is have a holistic look at the industry and try to put it on a more firm economic footing going forward. There are thousands of Alaskans who have started businesses, who are pursuing careers in this new industry that is uniquely Alaskan. As far as the number of folks around the table, respect your concern about the number of cooks in the kitchen. I would say to quote the book of Proverbs, without advice, plans go wrong, but with many advisors, they can succeed. And that is our hope with getting this group of informed and dedicated folks around the table to try and come up with solutions to this problem.
Thank you very much. I see nothing. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Additionally, it does not just look at taxation issues. It also looks at licensing, regulation, enforcement of fees and taxation, as well as ways the state can get ahead to make sure that we maintain an Alaska-owned industry here, owned and operated as it is now, and any other issues that they might need to look at could be addressed as well. So it's not just taxation. Additionally, the number of necessary changes to the composition of the Alaska Marijuana Control Board and various other things. So there is a slightly larger picture they'll be looking at.
Representative,
thank you. Alaska owned is great. However, and I don't know all the details, but if national law were to change, federal law were to change, and that we don't have control over, then this industry could be nationalized. So I could buy six-pack of Budweiser, a pack of Marlboro, and a pack of something else that is produced somewhere else besides Alaska. That conceivably could happen, that this task force or even here in the legislature may have not so much control over. Is that correct?
And Representative Wohl, to your question, again, for the record, Joe Hardenbrook from the Office of Representative Hopkins. One of the things the task force is specifically charged with is making suggestions on how to maintain the uniquely Alaskan flavor of Alaska's existing marijuana industry. Under current rules, regulations, and laws, license holders have to be a recipient of an Alaska Permanent Fund dividend. And while you're correct, if there is some sort of national movement to license, regulate, and tax marijuana on a national level, that will become a challenge. But this is a way to get out, as Representative Hopkins said, ahead of that question and try and anticipate how we might protect Alaskans who have invested in this industry should the national paradigm shift.
Representative Wall.
And also, thank you. I'm assuming consumers would be involved as well. You don't have any layperson consumers, but, you know, if someone said the only beer I could ever drink was Alaskan-made beer, there may be a bit of a problem with that. And I'm not suggesting you otherwise, but the market should also have a voice, I would imagine, too.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hopkins and Mr. Hardenbrook, for being here and for your patience today. And with that, our agenda has concluded. Our next meeting will be Monday afternoon, and we will begin consideration of budget amendments. Amendments will be due to Co-Chair Foster's office by today at 5 p.m. And with that, at 3:44 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you.